Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, second hour of Open Forum today. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Open Forum means any question that you have on the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church, anything you want to know about being Catholic, we are happy to take those questions. And you don't have to be Catholic to call, 888-318-7884. And with you, Jimmy, I usually feel comfortable taking calls of a broader religious nature and maybe calls on ethics or philosophy.
Sure. Carlo and I were just in my office discussing some ethical philosophical questions. So
I actually walked down the hall while the two of you were coming here, and then I was I came back in.
You're not going to go there, are you?
I'm not going to say you, but you were using an example to make a philosophical point, and I walked in on the middle of it, and I was like, "What are you guys talking about?"
Yeah.
But when you come in at the tail end of a conversation, sometimes you get.
Or in the middle.
Oh, the middle. Was that the middle?
You get some interesting examples.
But it is cool that I like being in a place where there's you can walk on in here at Catholic Answers on these on these conversations, and it's not just all like, oh, I've got all the answers. There's lots of things always that you got to tease out and that nobody knows or that you can disagree about and all that.
Yep.
Does Carlo have the courage to disagree with you or?
Oh, sure.
Does
I
he
would
really?
I would
what a brave
I would
man.
I would assume. I mean, I don't know that he ever has, but
it would be futile.
But I would assume. No.
888-318-7884.
I know where he would disagree with me about some stuff because I am completely unable to play the accordion and he is not unable to play the accordion.
No, he's
so
a really good accordion.
I would defer to him on that. Absolutely. Yeah. That's a skill he has and I have not cultivated.
Can you do like if – because you call dances.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, like
I call a bunch of different kinds of dances,
English
too.
Country dance, for example, or maybe even Morris dancing.
Mm-hmm.
Or
square dancing, contra dancing.
Could you do that with Carlo playing the –
Yeah, absolutely.
Is it a matter of like if it, as long as it has the right beat, then you can call the dance to it?
Yeah, like if he called anything in 2-2-4-4 or 6-8 time, and I could call modern Western square dance to it. And if he was able to do it in an ordinary like 64 beat musical phrase, I could call an ordinary contra dance to it. And yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. I'll show up if you guys do that.
Okay.
I bet a lot of people would show up for that. Open forum today on Catholic Answers Live, 888-31-TRUTH, the number. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Jimmy is the senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. And on these open forum days, Jimmy, I like to pick one of these. 365 days plus one means that you've got a full year of challenges to Catholic belief and then following each challenge, a defense. And these are all on a single page. And so they're
Well, that would be really small type. Each one is on a single page.
Oh, that's
they're
right.
Not all on a single page.
Okay. Let's see. And Carlo's still not afraid of you. You correct things like that if Carlo's not. I'm scared of Jimmy.
Friendly.
That was very friendly correction of my speaking style. I'm not hurt. I don't want you to think I'm hurt.
Good, because it would be far from my intention to hurt.
I know.
I'm just looking to add comedy for the listeners.
I know. Okay, so each time that we get you here on Open Forum, I like to ask a question from the book and see if you remember the answer. And I do them pretty randomly, and this time it's completely randomly. The dating of Acts.
Oh, okay.
Acts isn't reliable history. It was written long after the events.
Well, so there are different schools of thought about when Acts was written. A common view in biblical scholarship is that it was written around the year 80, 80. And if that's the case, well, it records events through about AD 60, or even most people will say 62, although personally I think it's 60. And so if it was written in 80 or 85, then that's like 18 to 23 years after the events in question. Well, there are all kinds of books of a historical nature that are written vastly longer after the events they describe that are nevertheless considered good and reliable books of history.
Yeah.
So I would say that that for that reason alone, you can't say that Acts is going to be unreliable just because of its date. I would also say that I don't actually personally think that it was written in AD 80 or after. I think it was written earlier than that. When you read the book of Acts, Luke focuses primarily on Peter and Paul, Peter in the first 12 chapters of Acts, and then Paul from chapter 13 to chapter 28. And the last seven chapters of Acts, from like chapter 21 to 28, are all building up to Paul, to a very important event in Paul's life, his appearance before Caesar. And at the time, that would have been Nero. This is before the fire of Rome, which happened in 64, and it's before Nero started persecuting Christians. So there was no reason to think Nero would be particularly hostile to Christians. And in fact, his wife Poppaea was friendly to Judaism. And he had some positive interactions with some Jews. One of his favorite actors, for example, is Jewish. And so Paul has been warned prophetically that when he goes to Jerusalem, he's going to be arrested and he's going to end up appearing in Rome to preach the gospel before Caesar. He knows this is going to happen. He goes to Jerusalem anyway. He gets arrested. He spends 2 years in jail rather than bribe the governor, who wants a bribe so he can let him go. He won't do that. He's convinced he's going to go to Rome. When an attempt is made to release him into Jewish custody and let him be tried in the Jewish courts in Jerusalem, where he knows he's not going to get a fair trial, he invokes his right of Roman citizenship to appeal to Caesar. And so the new governor who's over him, Porcius Festus, tells him, well, you've appealed to Caesar, so to Caesar you shall go. And they ship him off, and even though it's late in the year and thus towards the close of the sailing season, so the Mediterranean is getting dangerous, and they encounter this storm that keeps them at sea for 2 weeks. They have no idea where they are. They finally shipwreck on Malta, and then they have to winter on Malta for 3 months, and then they finally make it to Rome in the spring of AD 60. Paul is enabled to be basically under house arrest. He has a private residence where he is still under detention, and he spends 2 years leading Bible studies. The end. Okay, that's the end of the book of Acts.
Something didn't happen.
Yeah, it's like we don't have closure here.
Yeah, right.
And the rules of basic, you know, storytelling, how to recount events in a way that makes sense to an audience, were the same then as they are now. And it really, if you think about it, it doesn't matter what Luke's what outcome Paul had when he appeared before Caesar. It would have suited Luke's purpose, because either he would have been acquitted, in which case Luke has story of triumphant victory, vindication of Christianity and its message.
Right.
Or if he had been punished, he would have had, if Paul had been punished by Nero or executed, he would have had suffering for the cause of the gospel, glorious martyr,
yeah,
as the conclusion to his book. And since he gives us neither of those, and he's just spent seven chapters, he spent a quarter of the book building up to this event and suddenly slams on the brakes without telling us the outcome of it, the logical conclusion that I've come to, and that others, including some liberal scholars like Adolf von Harnack, have come to, is that the reason the book cuts off then is because that's when Luke was writing. He didn't know the outcome of Paul's appearance before Caesar because it hadn't happened yet. And so that would tell us that the book of Acts was written about AD 60.
888-318-7884, the number. And if I read that your one page that you've written, it essentially gives me that same answer.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like you,
yep.
So it's almost like you memorized the book.
No.
Not quite. You just know the
answer. Sort of the opposite. It's like the book is disgorged from my memory.
Yeah. All right. Let's take a quick break. We've got lots of calls. The lines are full now, but they may open up at any time. So give a call, 888-318-7884, and we'll get to your calls right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
We'll be right back with more great answers from Jimmy today on Catholic Answers Live.
As legend tells it, 500 years ago, a disaffected Augustinian priest nailed his 95 theses to the door of the Wittenberg Cathedral. The evidence that he actually did this is pretty thin, but Martin Luther's objections to Catholic teachings concerning purgatory and indulgences set off a series of countless ruptures that the church suffers to this very day. The faithful Catholic wants to be God's instrument in healing these ruptures, but may not know where to begin. Join us this September 28th to 30th as we tackle the topic at Catholic Answers' 4th National Apologetics Conference, the Reunion of All Christians, a lively and inspiring conference designed to ignite and inform your faith. We've got an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to fire you up. Catholic historian Steve Weidenkopf, apologist Mark Brumley, apologist Devin Rose, plus all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. This is an event you don't want to miss. This is where it all begins. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to leave you wanting more. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today to register. That's CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm here to tell you about a very special promotion we look forward to every year, our annual store-wide summer sale in the online shop at Catholic.com. This online event includes savings of 10 to 50% and more in some cases on every book, track, CD, DVD, ebook, and MP3 we carry, including my new book, Why We're Catholic. With lower prices and a great selection, it's by far the best online Catholic sale of the summer. So log on now and all this month to the shop at shop.catholic.com. and take advantage of our very special prices. These materials will build up your faith because they're from the people you know and trust at Catholic Answers.
Call now with your question. 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. I am your host, Cy Kellett. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, and Bruce is on the line from Los Angeles, California, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Bruce, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. I'm coming back into the Catholic Church, oddly enough, because of the computer. So there's two questions I have. One is, how can we find a good way to use the computer to help in the Catholic Church? Because, you know, I'm not much of a guy who buttonholes people and evangelizes them, number one. But I'm pretty good with computers.
Okay.
Even though I date back to the old UNIVAC, days of the old UNIVAC. And then my second question, I don't fully understand on the papacy because I know he's the vicar, I believe, or deputy of Christ, or under deputy, something like that.
You're talking about the Pope.
This particular Pope holds some views that are, you know, somewhat on the left-wing side, which concerns me because I'm a very conservative. And some of the statements he's made seem very leftist politically. So how does that work?
Okay. Well, so let's deal with your first question first. First of all, welcome back to the church. So glad you're coming back and getting involved again. In terms of using the computer to evangelize, there are multiple ways of doing that. There are websites like Catholic.com, that's our website, where we have a lot of resources that are devoted to helping explain and defend the Catholic faith and that have a kind of evangelistic nature and an apologetic nature, which, you know, answers people's questions and concerns. And you know, we're just one of many websites like that. There are various channels on other websites like YouTube. We have a channel on YouTube, but so do other Catholic ministries. And so there's a lot of things that are already there online that are resources that can help, you know, people who are interested in the faith or wanting to learn about it or have some objections and need to have those dealt with. The real question is how to get the material from one person to another. And you mentioned you're not so much one for buttonholing people. But today online, we have social media, and that's sites like Facebook and Twitter and things like that. And people who use social media are able to share things that they've run across. So, for example, let's suppose you found a particular video on Catholic.com that you thought really said something, you know, that you liked, that helped explain some aspect of the Catholic faith. Well, you could take a link to that or just press an icon, actually, and share it on Facebook. And then the people that follow you on Facebook would be able to see that. And it wouldn't be like, you know, going to any one person and saying, hey, I think you ought to watch this, although you could do that too. But just generally sharing things to people in your social media channels will serve as a kind of evangelization. So that would be one logical way. Also, if you know, do your own writing on the subject, you're obviously free to share that. You can start a website. You can start a blog. You can share it on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or all kinds of other channels. The nice thing is today we have so many options that people can use to spread the gospel online for either very low or no cost. And so we're blessed in that regard. In terms of your second question, there's a tendency on many people's part to, and it's especially true in this country right now, because there's a lot of political polarization in this country, but there can be a tendency to want to divide up in terms of political tribes. I mean, that's why political parties exist. Humans have a natural inclination to group together based on certain commonalities and to form tribes, whether the commonalities are based on blood or viewpoint or whatever they may be based on. We have a natural tribal instinct. And as a result of that, we tend to look at people who are in our own tribe, whatever the nature of that is, more favorably, and people who are not in our tribe, who belong to a different tribe, less favorably. That's natural human tendency. But one of the things that Jesus calls us to is to resist that. If you look in the Sermon on the Mount, which is found in Matthew chapters 5 to 7, one of the things Jesus talks about is if you want to be sons of the Father, if you want to be sons of God, you need to treat people like God does. You need to not just greet those who greet you and treat kindly those who are kind to you. You need to treat kindly and look favorably on everybody, because God sends his rain and his sunshine on everybody. And in the ancient world, rain and sunshine were absolutely essential. They were what made the crops grow. And so Jesus's point is God gives his grace liberally to everybody. He doesn't just favor his own followers. He even favors his enemies, and that's what Jesus calls us to, is to pray even for people who persecute us. And so we need to, even though we have a natural instinct towards forming tribes, and that has some benefits that are there by God's design, under the influence of sin, it becomes something it shouldn't, and we need to resist that. And in particular, we need to resist the identification, or we need to resist the temptation to identify the Catholic faith with our own personal political views. Whatever our political views are, whether they're liberal or conservative or something else entirely, the Christian faith transcends all of that. The Christian faith is not about politics. There are moral implications of the Christian faith, and that means that there is some contact between aspects of the Christian faith and things in the political world. But we can't simply say, oh, well, Christianity is right wing or Christianity is left wing or anything like that. It doesn't match up in that way. And that's not the analysis Jesus called us towards. We need to resist the implication to view everything through the lens of politics. And that applies to the Christian faith. It also applies to particular individuals, including the Pope. One of the problems we have today is the media is obsessed with politics. I mean, you turn on any channel, radio, television, you're going to find every event being looked at through a political lens. And what does this say about which political tribe? Well, unfortunately, that can result in distorted reporting. And so you oftentimes have Pope Francis being reported as a leftist or a communist even, when in fact he's not. The politics in his native Argentina don't fall neatly into that left-right paradigm. And so his own personal political background, he's not a communist. He's not a leftist in that sense. Hard right Republican either. He's more complex than that. And the media has a tendency, because of its left right divide up the tribes politically view, way of viewing things, tends to want to pigeonhole him in a way that's actually not accurate.
Bruce, thank you so much for that call. Because of time limits, we're going to move on. Robert in Camden, Missouri, listening on Covenant Radio Network. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Mr. Akins. I would like to just ask two short, brief, biblical related
really
questions.
Quick, what are they?
Okay. In terms of, should we interpret the Bible literally when it comes to teaching children with a handicap or teenagers about Scripture? And the second one is, what does it mean if in the last chapter of the book of Revelation to take away from the words or add to the words the Bible?
Okay.
Of the book of Revelation, please.
Okay. Well, let's deal with the second question first, because it's certainly easier. At the end of the book of Revelation, this is Revelation 22 for anybody who wants to look it up, there is a warning that says if anybody adds to the words of this book, God is going to add to him the plagues described in this book. And if anyone takes away from the words of this book, God is going to take away from him his portion in the tree of life. So basically, it's a warning not to tamper with the contents of this book. And in some circles, people will want to interpret this book as referring to the entire Bible. And really, though, it's not. The Bible in the ancient world was never a single book. At the time, books were typically scrolls, and you could never fit the entire Bible in one scroll. It would be impossible, because just unrolling it, it would rip in half. And so scrolls had a definite length that wasn't, in fact, too much larger than an individual book of the Gospels. That's why the Gospels are about as long as they are, is because that was the length of a typical scroll. The same thing is true of the book of Revelation. It was an individual volume, and that's what people would have understood to be this book. When they got the book of Revelation, let's say you were living in Ephesus, which was one of the places Revelation was addressed to, and St. John had written the book and had copies made and sent it to Ephesus, and you're an Ephesian in the church at Ephesus, and somebody gets up to read Revelation, they don't have a big Bible in their hands. They have the one single book of Revelation in their hands. And that's thus the natural interpretation. When it says don't add to or take away from the words of this book, it means don't tamper with the text of Revelation. Now, and if you do, it has serious consequences. Now, of course, the same thing's true of all the other books of Scripture. They're all divinely inspired. We shouldn't be tampering with their texts either. And there will be serious consequences if you were to. But that's the basic meaning of that passage. In terms of the first question you asked about, should we interpret the Bible literally when teaching children with handicaps about the faith, I think that the answer, if I understand you correctly, is going to be a little subtle. When teaching anybody about the faith, you want to teach according to their capacity. And so if someone is a child and has limited capacity, that means that you may have to and will have to drop out some of the subtleties of the faith that they can then learn as they grow. And that will mean, in some cases, teaching them about the Bible in terms that don't go into all the detail about, well, this is a symbol and here's what it means, because they may not be ready to understand that yet. But you do want to fill that in over the course of time. So, for example, if I could imagine, let's suppose I was teaching a very small child about how God made the world, and I could I could say, okay, well, here's what it says in Genesis 1, and I could read them the account in Genesis 1. Now, that account involves some symbolism, but they might be so young that they're not ready to understand about that, and so I wouldn't go into that. But I also wouldn't mislead them and imply that stuff is not symbolic when, in fact, it is. And so if they then came to me and said, you know, well, what about dinosaurs? Well, then I'd have to, you know, if they're old enough to ask the question, I assume they're old enough to hear the answer. And so I would explain that although Genesis 1 talks about the truth about how God made the world, it's not all meant to be strictly chronological, and dinosaurs fit in there too. In the case of someone who says maybe has a mental handicap, I'd apply the same approach. I'd teach as much as they're able to understand. I wouldn't try to overburden them. But if they ask questions, I'll do my best to help them understand according to their present level of understanding.
Thanks, Robert. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, Catholic Answers Open Forum, right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Christian men, beware. With the idols of materialism, entertainment, and the flesh, it's plain to see that the world wants you for its own. Face it, it's tempting and easy to be a man of the world. Father Terence Ehrman has a challenge for you. Be a man of God instead. In his new book, Man of God, Lessons to Young Men About Life, Sex, Friendship, Vocation, and Loving with the Heart of Christ, Father Ehrman draws on his experiences counseling men who are struggling to live in the world but not be of the world. In a unique format, he offers a plan for ongoing conversion, holy spiritual direction for all men who want to master themselves and be transformed from within. Order your copy of Man of God today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking new resource by apologist Trent Horn, that one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. In a series of short, easy-to-read chapters, Trent covers the whole range of common topics, starting with why we believe in anything at all and answering all the common objections to the Catholic faith, both doctrinal and moral. Don't miss out on the most important, life-changing book to come along in years. Better yet, it's only $3 a copy when you order in bulk. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
More to Life with Dr. Greg and Lisa Popchak.
More to Life is about living the Catholic difference in our marriages, our families, the way we approach life in general.
It's about celebrating life and our Catholic faith and discovering all the ways God wants to bless us and help us be a blessing to others.
More to Life with Dr. Greg and Lisa Popchak, weekdays 10 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks for being with us for this open forum today. Jimmy Akin, our guest, 888-31-TRUTH, our number. And if you live in the San Diego area and you want to hear Jimmy speak, he's speaking at St. Elizabeth Catholic Church on miracles, revelations, and supernatural gifts this Sunday.
Yeah,
did you know you're doing that?
I did. In fact, I was working on it, working on that speech just today.
And I'm going to be speaking on five great deceptions we face today at Santa Sofia Catholic Church after the 8 o'clock Mass, 9:15 on Sunday. So come by. I don't know. Are any of these being live streamed? Some of these get live streamed. Some don't. Do you know?
In the case of mine, I'm not sure.
Okay. So if you want more information, just go to the Catholic Answers Facebook page. Or you can give us a call at 888-291-8000. They'll give you the information there. Again, open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Happy to take your calls on any aspect of the Catholic faith. We really do encourage you, if you're not Catholic and you have a question, give a call. We will try to be as respectful and helpful as we can be. Paul in Duluth, Georgia, listening on 98.1 FM. Your question for Jimmy Akin, please.
Hey, guys. My question is, what exactly is heaven and hell? Like, are there like scientific thinkers in the Catholic community or theologians who have plausible opinions about any kind of physicality, materially, what heaven and purgatory are? That's what I know. Purgatory is separate from heaven.
Right.
I know heaven is the final destination, and purgatory is a purgation period for people who are about to get to heaven. I'm wondering if there's any kind of physical understanding at all of what they are.
Well, okay. So here's what I can tell you: the church understands these primarily in terms of being spiritual states rather than physical locations. So heaven, the essence of heaven, is being spiritually united with God in a way that enables you to behold what's known as the beatific vision, which is an intellectual, not a physical vision of God, but an intellectual apprehension of his goodness and his nature. Purgatory is a process of purification that occurs prior to one's entrance into the full reality of heaven. So it's a kind of temporary thing. But you're already united with God in some way in greater than in this life, even when you're in purgatory. The definitions of heaven and purgatory, and for that matter, hell, which is exclusion from God's presence, they're all really states of relationship to God. That's the essence of each of those three states. How that plays out in terms of physical location is something that is unclear. Most of the people who are in heaven at the moment or in purgatory don't presently have bodies, and because they're dead and so have not been resurrected yet. And so they don't have bodies, and therefore it's unclear to what extent they could or would occupy any physical location. So it's not like you can look in the universe somewhere here in the physical universe of space and time and say, well, this is where these souls are located. There are, depictions in art of like hell being down deep in the earth and heaven being up in the sky, but those are symbolic. Souls are not literally up in the sky or down in the earth. Those are just ways of visualizing relationships with God, which is the essence of the different states. Having said that, it does seem that there is time or something very much like time in heaven, because souls can progress from one state to another. They can go from being in purgatory to not being in purgatory, for example. So there is an example of a shift either occurring in time or something like time. They can also go from being disembodied after death to being embodied again in the resurrection. Also, and so there seems to be a kind of time-like aspect, or even just straight-out time, that applies to these states. And if that's the case, then space can apply in some way too, because space and time are basically two sides of the same coin. In fact, we have evidence that heaven is at least capable of receiving physical bodies, because Jesus took his body there, and Mary has her body there, and Elijah seems to have his body there. And so it, even if they're not manifested by being spread out in space the way we are in our present bodies, heaven at least seems to be capable of receiving physical bodies in some way. Also, we know that at the end of the world, we will have a new heaven and a new earth where heaven and earth are united again. So the way the book of Revelation depicts it, we will be living in our new bodies on the new earth, which apparently is spatial, in the spiritual state of being fully united with God. So heaven and earth are together in that. And thus the book of Revelation says the dwelling place of God is with men on the new earth in the final state of things. So we don't really know a lot about this area. We have to leave a lot of this up to God, and we'll just have to see. But that kind of sketches some of the basic principles involved.
Okay, Paul?
Okay, thanks. You pretty much answered the crux of my question. I just always found it the most interesting topic, really.
Yeah, it's great to think about.
Thank you, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
We go now to Eli in Biddeford, Maine, listening on 106.7 FM. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, this is Nate, not Eli. Do you want to go to Eli, or should I go ahead?
Oh, well, now that we've got you, Nate, apparently there was a cross-up, but you're in Dallas, Texas, listening on EWTN, right?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
All right, okay. Eli, hang on a second. We'll get to you. Nate, what's your question for Jimmy Akin?
Well, nice to talk to you both. I called on May 30th, the end of the hour, and I rushed through my question, and Jimmy, unfortunately, provided an answer that I wasn't totally happy with, so I'm hoping to call back and give a recap very quickly and then jump into my response.
So what's your question? Because we're coming up on a break, and I want to give you the best answer I can in the time available. What's your question today?
So my question is, why does God violently and sometimes without warning punish people with death? Just the one time, and sometimes not even the first time that it's happened, and not certainly the last time that some sin is ever committed that makes him angry. And so is that not an abusive relationship where just a smiting comes down from the heavens and you responded with, that's not always the case, and we have prophets and so forth. So I wanted to ask, what about the kids who mocked Elisha? What about the flood? What about Ahab and Jezebel's kids who were punished with death for Ahab's and Jezebel's sins? What about Onan, Uzzah? What about David's son who was killed for David's sin? There are numerous examples of God punishing with death without warning, sometimes even the kids of the sinners. And doesn't that seem wrong?
Okay. Well, you named a whole bunch of examples there, and they're not all of the same character. So I'm not going to be able to go through each one of them. I didn't take notes on precisely the examples you mentioned, and I'll do the best I can with the time I have, and I hope that'll be of assistance. In terms of this question, Catholic theology has a range of opinions that are permitted among Catholic theologians regarding how these passages should be interpreted. There is a school of thought that says that all life is a gift, and therefore it's up to God to determine how much of that gift you get. And you have no claim on God to say, well, I should have gotten more than I did. That's just not something that you have a right to. It's all a gift. And therefore, it's not unjust for God to say, well, I'm gonna take away this person's life, either because they've committed some sin or even without them committing a sin. And so there's no fundamental injustice there. One of the themes that is found in Scripture is that God will stand up for people who have suffered unjustly, and he'll make sure that even if someone did suffer in this life, and even if they did suffer unjustly, he'll more than make it up to them in the next life. This is one of the things that St. Paul talks about, which is that if it doesn't matter what the sufferings of the present life are, what God has waiting for us will be so glorious that it more than makes up for that. And so he says that the sufferings of the present life aren't even worth comparing to what is in store for us. In terms of the of God on this interpretation, killing people who have committed a sin, well, he has provided them with witnesses. He has provided them with the prophets. That's something we talked about last time. He's also provided them with moral consciences. The law of God is written on the hearts of men, and you should instinctively know that certain things are right and wrong. And if you do something gravely wrong, there can be consequences for it, either just from the nature of the act itself, or you may run afoul of human justice, or on this view, you could run afoul of divine justice. That doesn't make it abusive any more than it makes it abusive to say, well, guess what? I'm going to go out and get drunk, and I'm going to drunk drive, and maybe I'll get away with it a few times. But if the cops catch me, it's suddenly abusive for the cops to hold me accountable for that. That doesn't make it abusive. Neither does it make it abusive to say, well, okay, I got tipsy that one time and a cop caught me, but he had mercy and let me go. But then the next time he didn't, and that was somehow unjust. Well, you should count yourself lucky, if anything, that you got leniency on one occasion. But just because you got leniency on one occasion does not give you a right to leniency on all occasions. So that kind of sketches this approach, which is based on the idea that God might actually literally take somebody's life. Then there's another approach, which other theologians would advocate, which would say that when we have passages like this in Scripture that talk about God taking somebody's life because they've committed a sin, really what that means is not that God is actively taking that person's life, but he's allowing the natural consequences of that person's sin to unfold. And so he's not stopping it, but he is not actively causing it, just like he's not literally angry. And this is something that Catholic theologians of all perspectives would acknowledge. God is not literally angry. God is all perfect. He has, therefore, all beatitude, all happiness. And emotions really don't actually apply to him in the same way they do to us because of the nature of his being. He doesn't have the physical sensations of emotions the way we do. And so when we read in Scripture about God being angry with something, it doesn't indicate that he's literally angry. It instead indicates that something either has been done or is being done or could be done that is immoral and that can trigger bad consequences or that can lead in some way to bad consequences as part of God's plan. But it doesn't mean he's literally angry. The description of him as being angry is something that is symbolic motive language that's used by the biblical authors because God so fundamentally transcends human categories that in order for us to relate to him, we invariably have to use certain forms of language that kind of accommodate the truth about God to our ability to understand him. And theologically, that language is called anthropomorphic language. It's language that depicts God as if he were a man, but he's actually not, and we have to take that into account when we read these texts.
Nate, thank you so much for that call. Eli, hang on. I'll get to you as soon as we come back on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Call and ask Jimmy your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Hey everyone, Carlo Broussard here, and I'm here to tell you about a very special promotion we look forward to every year, our annual store-wide summer sale in the online shop at Catholic.com. This spectacular online event includes savings of 10 to 50% and more in some cases on every book, tract, CD, DVD, ebook, and MP3 we carry, including my new DVD, Why God Still Matters. With lower prices and a great selection, it's by far the best online Catholic sale of the summer. So log on now and all this month to the shop at shop.catholic.com and take advantage of our very special prices. You know it's all good stuff because it's from the people you know and trust at Catholic Answers.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serbin. In Matthew 10:7, Jesus told his apostles, "As you go, make this proclamation. The kingdom of God is at hand. Cure the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, drive out demons. Without cost you have received, without cost you are to give. Do not take gold or silver or copper for your belts. No sack for the journey or a second tunic or sandals or a walking stick. The laborer deserves his keep. Whoever will not receive you or listen to your words, go outside that house or town and shake the dust from your feet." Obviously, the word they were preaching was not a message that was so watered down that it could not offend anybody. Nothing about them was to suggest that they were preaching the good news about an earthly kingdom. Their message was that our true home is heaven, not here, and he is the only way to get there. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. We'll try to move through questions as quickly as we can this segment because we want to get to as many as we can. We go now to, I promised before and didn't, and now I will go to Eli in Biddeford, Maine, listening on 106.7 FM. Eli, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. I'm sorry that I did that to you before.
Oh, it's okay. In any case, my question is, do you expect Catholics and Protestants to reconcile anytime soon? And with all reconciling, it's always going to have some compromise on both sides. What form do you think that will take?
Okay. So we have to differentiate between different levels of reconciliation in terms of the number of people involved. Obviously, there can be reconciliation of individual Protestants with the Catholic Church. That happened to me. I used to be Protestant. So when that happens, it's obvious that the individual Protestant just joins the Catholic Church, becomes a Catholic, and no special accommodations typically are made for that. It's not necessary in those cases. In other cases, there can be situations where groups of Protestants are reconciled with the church. And in those cases, frequently there can be, or at least potentially, there can be special accommodations that are made for that. An example would be the recent creation of the Anglican ordinariate system that is in use that Pope Benedict developed. There were groups of Anglicans in different countries who wanted to be reconciled with the Catholic Church. They also wanted to preserve certain forms of their Anglican heritage, and so it was arranged for them to have special organizations known as ordinariates that would allow them to come into the church and be fully Catholic, but also to retain some elements of their Anglican heritage. That's not dissimilar to what are known as sometimes called the Eastern Rites of the Catholic Church. Really what we mean there, rite is a liturgical term. It's not quite appropriate here. The formal term for the different Eastern Catholic churches is churches sui juris. That means churches with their own law. And they're also they're not coming from a Protestant background, but they're coming from a background, many of them, which for a time was out of union with the Catholic Church. But then they came back in as a group, and they were because of the differences in their history and their patrimony religiously and liturgically and legally, they were allowed to have their own law, and so they're known as churches sui juris. That's generally not the path that's been established for returning Protestant groups because the Protestant groups all split off from the Latin Church. The tendency thus far has been to reincorporate them into the Latin Church, but make whatever special provisions are necessary. So I'd be a little surprised if in the future there was, say, a Lutheran church sui juris, but I wouldn't be surprised if there was a Lutheran ordinariate of Lutherans, people from a Lutheran background who had embraced Catholic teaching and wanted to come back into the Catholic Church. I could imagine that happening. Maybe not in my lifetime, but maybe in the next couple of centuries it could happen. There is impetus towards a reunification. That's something that's been clear over the last century. It's been clearly manifest and has continued to play out. In fact, just this week, there was an important signing of a document known as the Joint Declaration on the Doctrine of Justification. This document was originally released in 1999. It was a joint statement on one of the thorniest issues of the Protestant Reformation, justification. It was a signing between the Catholic Church and the Lutheran World Federation. And in 2006, I believe, the Methodists, the World Methodist Council, joined. And just in this last week, the major body of Reformed Christians joined. So that would include, you know, Presbyterians and Waldensians and United Church and various people like that. A bunch of people who belong to the Reformed tradition have also joined it now. And so there are clear motions towards reunification. There are also challenges. An obvious example would be female ordination to the priesthood and the episcopacy in some of these churches. That's going to be a major barrier that didn't used to exist. And it's one of the reasons why there was a division in the Anglican community that led to some Anglicans wanting to come back to the Catholic Church and others not wanting to come back to the Catholic Church. Similar things could replicate in other Protestant communities. I would not expect anytime soon to see a mass reunion of all Protestants in the Catholic Church. I don't think that's a practical possibility anytime soon or in all likelihood ever before the Second Coming. But I do expect that there will be continued efforts towards reconciliation, and by God's will and by His grace at times, hopefully we'll see some fruit materializing from that.
Okay, Eli?
Thank you.
Eli, hang on. Do you ever listen to Catholic Answers Focus, our podcast?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, on the podcast, we did a nice interview about a month ago. I think it was May 12th with an Anglican ordinariate priest. And so if you want more information on that, I thought it made me happy, that interview. So you might want to go give it a listen. Gives you a little sense of what it's like from the side of a person who comes from the Anglican church into the full communion with the Catholic faith. Thanks, Eli, very much for that call.
Oh, so that interview made you happy.
Which one made me unhappy? Why do you the one you did with me?
No, I'm just kidding.
No, I was really happy with that interview.
Oh, good. Not this one is what you're saying.
No, this is horrible. I was going to talk to you after this show. Like, Jimmy, what's going wrong with you today? Eli, thank you for that call. It's Catholic.com/focus if you want to get our weekly podcast. They really are good. Jarrah in San Antonio, Texas, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. You are on with Jimmy Akin. What's your question?
Hi, thank you for hearing my question. My question is, with the understanding that the Vatican walls were built for safety reasons, why are they still up? What are they protecting, and why are we using the Swiss Guard?
Okay, well, we're using the Swiss Guard for papal defense, and not just the Swiss Guard, but they're kind of, for people who may not be entirely familiar with the Swiss Guard, they're the guys you see in footage of the Vatican wearing the really colorful kind of medieval-looking uniforms. They are a bodyguard for the Pope, but they're not the only one. There's also another security service that's more low-key. They kind of have a ceremonial role, kind of like, when you see Buckingham Palace, they have those guards out front that have the red uniforms and the big shakos, the Busbys.
That's what that's called, that big black hat?
Mm-hmm, oh. Yeah. And they have – they're both guards, but they're also kind of play a ceremonial role that communicates the dignity and honor of the place. And the Swiss Guards kind of do that as well. In addition to the Swiss Guards, as I mentioned, there's another security service at the Vatican, and their job is to protect the public order at the Vatican, because people can come in there, and it's quite open, actually. I mean, if you look at St. Peter's Square, it has no gates. There's a kind of portico on both sides, but there's just a big open space with no gates, and people can come in there and they could do all kinds of stuff, and you need people to keep order. Just like in any city, you need a police force to provide some kind of order, and Vatican City has that. Among their duties, in addition to just keeping order and, stopping crime, they also have the function of protecting the Pope, because they're are people out there in the world who have it in for the Pope. Praise God, we haven't yet had a major act of, say, terrorism at the Vatican, though there have been people in the Islamic world who have threatened the Pope, but that's what they're there for. To some extent, the walls at the Vatican, where there are walls, fulfill that same function, but also they're there because they haven't been torn down, because you don't unnecessarily start dismantling buildings and major structures without a need to, and thus far they haven't seen a need to.
Thanks, Jarrah. Thanks, everybody who called. Thank you, Jimmy Akin, for being with us.
Thank you, Cy Kellett, for being able to be here to be with.
And this interview did make me happy.
Oh, good.
It's just that I was happy to hear from the Anglican perspective.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
It was very.
I know. I'm just adding humor for the listeners.
I know. Tomorrow, the Church in the News. Matthew Bunsen will be here with us to talk about the Church in the News. And we'll finish the week with a discussion of the saints with Father Paul Scalia. That's all that tomorrow on Catholic Answers Live. We'll see you then, God willing.